This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In January, our reporter Ben Taub traveled to Mauritania in Western Africa in order to meet with a man named Mohamedou Salahi. His story is the subject of our entire program today. When Salahi was sent to Guantanamo Bay, one of the most damning pieces of evidence is that he had once received a call from Osama bin Laden's satellite phone. Salahi's cousin was a high-ranking al-Qaeda member very close to bin Laden, and this cousin had once used bin Laden's phone to call Salahi. While Salahi was subjected to torture at Guantanamo, his cousin, Abu Hafs al-Mauritani, was never captured by the United States. He lives freely now in his home country of Mauritania, and while Ben Taub was reporting there, he ran into Abu Hafs at a party.
He gave me a phone number and said, "Call this number, it's for my secretary." The next day, I did call. He told me, "Come to my house right now."
Here's staff writer Ben Taub.
Abu Hafs al-Mauritani is a man of extraordinary influence and power. He lives in one of Nouakchott's most expensive neighborhoods, near the sea. It's made up of lavish compounds, many of which belong to European expatriates. But one building is out of place. It's a small wooden shack sitting up against one of these compounds. This is the temporary site of a mosque where Abu Hafs preaches.
There's a group of young Salafi men going into this shack, wooden shack, with a loudspeaker hooked up to the top to pray for the evening. This is called a prayer.
As I approach his house, I go on Google Maps and drop a pin on my exact location. I send that pin to my editor in New York and give him the phone numbers for certain people he should contact in Mauritania if I can't check in within 4 hours. Abu Hafs finishes leading prayers and invites me to follow him into his compound. We walk through the gate, and he closes it behind me and brings me into his living room. I sit down on his couch. Several of his followers come in, too.
Yes,
you're welcome. Go ahead.
Great. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. In the article, how would
it was me and my translator. Since I'd come to his house in such a hurry, the only person available was one of Mohamedou's nephews. And since Mohamedou and Abu Hafs are cousins, that means he's also one of Abu Hafs's nephews.
So this is the question.
I sat down on the couch and he poured me a glass of water.
Yeah.
Bush. W. Bush, Jordan.
Yeah.
September 11th.
After 9/11.
Yeah.
I wanted to make clear that I was not there to relitigate his past in al-Qaeda or to blame him for 9/11. In fact, I knew from the 9/11 Commission report that Abu Hafs opposed the attacks. When he first learned about the plan, he stood up in a Shura Council meeting and defied bin Laden, saying that the scale of civilian casualties was indefensible in Islamic law. So he's especially sensitive about anyone linking him to 9/11, even though he knew about it before it took place.
So if the terrorists, if they are interested only to attack.
I had come to Abu Hafs to learn two things. How did he feel about the fact that his cousin, whom he'd grown up with, who he had followed to Afghanistan, had essentially gone to Guantanamo Bay in his place? And how is it that Abu Hafs, this al-Qaeda leader who had a $25 million bounty on his head, was never captured and was living openly in the same country from which Mahamadou had been renditioned by the CIA? Those were my questions. But it was clear that Abu Hafs had other things on his mind.
You live in the West and you have a great mind.
And this is a great thing
to guide you to the truth. Everyone who looks for the truth, if he are interested in it, the God will guide you to the truth.
Good afternoon. On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in October 2001, Abu Hafs was living in Kandahar. He knew he had to leave the country, and so he traveled through remote villages, entrusting his life to Afghan shepherds who were presumably unaware of the $25 million bounty on his head. He made it to Pakistan, which was clearly giving sanctuary to many Taliban fighters, but he worried that they would turn him over to the CIA. Officially, if unreliably, Pakistan is a counterterrorism partner of the United States. And in Pakistan, Abu Hafs and the other al-Qaeda fighters, who were mostly Arabs, stood out. In an emergency meeting with other al-Qaeda leaders, he came up with a plan. The safest place, he thought, was a place that had no relationship to the Americans. He had to get to Iran.
I chose Iran for many reasons.
What Abu Hafs guessed correctly is that the Iranians understood his value. They would have the al-Qaeda leadership living in their custody. And during that time, there would be no al-Qaeda operations within Iranian territory. For the next decade, he lived partly as a prisoner, partly as a guest.
Yes, I stayed in Iran 10 years.
Uh-huh.
I was in a house. Every 2 days, I have the opportunity to go outside for the shower and for the to do a shower and everything.
Technically, he was under house arrest. But he was the kind of detainee who gets escorted to fancy malls, who works out in the same gym as foreign diplomats, who has a cell phone and internet access. This was at the same time that his cousin, Mahamadou Salahi, was being tortured at Guantanamo Bay. For the next decade, while Abu Hafs was living in Iran, Mauritania was the site of regular jihadi violence. But it stopped abruptly in 2011, and it was around that time that Abu Hafs realized he could go home.
And one day, I decide that when I went to do the shower and to the gym and everything, yeah, I'll take the card away, mm-hmm, and go away.
Okay, to the embassy.
Yeah.
Abu Hafs slipped out of Iranian custody during a trip to the gym. He bolted into the changing room and into the street. And dressed in his gym clothes, he hailed a taxi to the Mauritanian embassy in Tehran.
Yes, and the ambassador called the foreign minister, mm-hmm, and that called the president, and the president told them all to make sure that he's okay, mm-hmm, and they have to do everything to bring him back to Mauritania.
In order to avoid detection by the Americans, they booked him on a commercial route through three transit countries.
It's an amazing story.
It's very amazing.
In fact, could I ask him some questions about the Mahamadou's case?
Yes, Dinik, the whole time you ask me, now I will ask you one question.
Please.
And this question might lead you to a very successful life.
Okay.
Are you a Christian or a Jew?
No, I'm not.
الله تبارك وتعالى يقول أيحسب الإنسان.
If now you ask yourself,
أهم سؤال.
Now if you see a big machine, a complicated machine, if you want to make sure about this machine or this thing, you should read the manufacturer's book for this machine to make sure everything.
قول له الجهاز هو هو. قول له الجهاز هو.
The machine is you.
والكتالوج هو هذا القرآن.
And the rule for that is the Quran.
He handed me a French translation of the Quran.
This is the manual for
The manual for the for you.
لا بد أن تقرأ. أنا أقول لا أقترح عليك شيئا.
If you died at the moment, you will go to the hell.
قل يمكن أن ينقذ نفسه من هذا المصير السيء الذي لا نريده له بشهادة أن لا إله إلا الله وأن محمد رسول.
We don't want you to go to the hell.
قل هو يستطيع بجملة يقولها بلسانه.
And you can do by one phrase. You said it by your tongue.
يعتقدها بقلبه.
And you believe in your heart.
Yes, and the phrase is the Shahada.
The Shahada is one sentence. There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. When someone wants to convert to Islam, they say this phrase in the presence of Muslim witnesses. In this moment, it became clear to me that Abu Hafs wanted me to convert, right here, on his couch.
The Sheikh, he wants you to try, inshallah ta'ala, to book your place in the paradise. Mm-hmm. And it is an easy thing, just by one phrase.
Yes.
It's very easy, but just you can try it.
But there was another part that he said. He said, you have to say the Shahada, and you have to
believe
in your heart. Yes. And to understand the second part, I need to finish reading this first.
But no one, he has the experience what will be tomorrow, because we can die now.
Yes, but I
didn't get the sense that he was threatening me, but you feel very vulnerable in a former Al-Qaeda leader's house. And Abu Hafs's followers were getting agitated that I was not receptive to his message. The fact is, the Shahada is supposed to be a sincere profession of faith, something one chooses to do when one is ready. I hadn't even read the Quran. So I was now in this almost comical situation where I'm explaining to this man, a fundamentalist who considers himself a religious leader, why my spontaneous conversion wouldn't be legitimate in Islam.
Yes, but I can't fulfill the Shahada properly until I've read the book.
But you can't say the Shahada and then you read the book.
قلوا ما الذي يمنعه منها؟
He said two things.
I still needed to ask him about Muhammadu, so I had to figure out a way to pivot out of the talk of conversion and get back to the interview. So I tried to frame it in terms that he would understand.
Urgency, what I would like to do if possible is finish the questions tonight in case the police get me out of Martinique, because they don't like journalists.
Yes. Right, you know? So
he understands the kinds of pressures that security intelligence apparatuses use on individuals. He's been subjected to it in the past.
I'm curious, I just have a couple of questions about Muhammadu's case.
If it's okay.
So he wrote in his book that, and the Americans claim, that one time you called him from Bin Laden's satellite phone. Is that correct? And if so, what did you discuss?
No relationship with the jihad or something.
Yeah, well, Muhammadu told me, and he said it was about money to help your father who was sick. Is that right?
Yes, I transferred to him some money.
Okay. Then the other thing was about Muhammadu. And I guess the kind of uncomfortable question, and I don't mean to insult, but I wonder, does he think that Muhammadu would have ever been arrested if he had not been in Al-Qaeda? Not Muhammadu,
It's no relationship.
That was pretty much all he had to say on the subject of his cousin spending 15 years in Guantanamo Bay. And then he thanked me for coming.
And the happiness, you have never find the happiness without you believe in the God, the real belief.
Yeah.
That night, I went to Mahamudu's apartment and told him what had happened.
It's true. But this fit along with his general pattern of being, like, relatively dismissive and, like, not interested in your plight, you know?
Oh, yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
You're right. That's very dismissive. He's more interested in saving your soul.
Exactly.
His soul is not important to him.
What was the other call?
It was around 8 p.m. on my last night. I went to his apartment to say goodbye to him. And he was packing up his stuff and said he needed to leave for the night because one of his aunts had died. That aunt was also Abu Hafsa's aunt. And so the family was going to head out in convoy, drive overnight and bury her at dawn. And Abu Hafs was going to be in the convoy. Abu Hafs was going to lead the prayer at dawn. Encounters like this are basically inevitable. Mahamudu can try to separate himself from Abu Hafs, but in Nouakchott, he can't escape his orbit. And Mahamudu can't leave the country because, as a condition of his release from Guantanamo, the Americans made the Mauritanian government promise to not issue him a passport for some unknown period of time. So he's stuck. He can't get the surgery he needs to correct the botched surgery he had at Guantanamo. He can't go see his wife. He has never even met his son. He can't live as a free man. And yet, he harbors no resentment toward the United States. He has forgiven his tormentors. He's passionate about democracy and the rule of law. He's obsessed with principles that the United States publicly espouses, but has never extended to him.
I was never charged, let alone convicted of any crimes against your country. I'm just a peaceful person, and I never hurt anyone, and I don't intend to hurt anyone, and I just want the same freedom. Like, I'm risking a lot by speaking out about this stuff, because I was told many times that this is not good for me. And I said, I'm not going to shut up. And I will not shut up because I want freedom. I want the same freedom that American citizens enjoy in the United States. Why is that impossible? Why? I just need an answer and I'll be on my way.
Mohamedou Salahi, speaking with Ben Taub earlier this year. You can find Ben Taub's article, Guantanamo's Darkest Secret, at NewYorker.com. Salahi's book, Guantanamo Diary, was published in 2015 while he was still in detention. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and thank you for joining us. I hope you'll join us again next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. The program is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.